Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out until our 29th year of marriage that we were a neurodiverse couple. And we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And I am so excited today because this marks the first episode of season 5 that I am doing with one of my new guest co-hosts. And I had the opportunity to release or publish the podcast I did with Nicole Knowlton. And it went so great, I asked her if she would be willing to be a guest co-host. So Nicole, welcome. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you, Mona. As Mona said, I'm Nicole, and I'm a neurodiverse therapist. I am autistic with ADHD and was in a neurodiverse marriage, and am a mother to 2 neurodivergent teenagers. And I'm really happy to be back.
Oh, this is going to be fun. And so for the folks that are listening, I think I'm now at over 120 episodes. And one of the things that I realized is that I now call myself a non-autistic person because I know I have a lot of ADHD traits, but I will never be able to speak from all the different perspectives. So each one of the guest co-hosts is going to be able to share from their perspective. And what I want to invite all of you to think about is if you have questions that you'd like to ask me or the guest co-host, please send them through my email at neurodiverselove, the number 4, letter U, at gmail.com. So today, Nicole and I are going to talk about, I think, something that is really, really important, both for the autistic partner and for the non-autistic partner and for the family. And that is stigma, fear, and the challenges around how you deal with maybe your family or even your partner not acknowledging that you're neurodiverse. So I'd love, if you want to start, Nicole, that would be fantastic. I'm also comfortable starting. I'd like to start by talking about the stigma piece. And I know that is a big issue for a lot of folks. So do you want to share with the audience maybe some of the stigma that you felt? Because I know you've been recently diagnosed. Mm-hmm. Is there something that you want to share about that? And maybe some of the things that you have heard couples share or individuals who are recently diagnosed?
Yes, a lot of different ideas and thoughts come to mind as you know, we talk about this topic. And I can share that, you know, I just was recently diagnosed last year, at the beginning of last year, and it was really eye-opening. It was eye-opening about my own views and experiences about autism and my own clinical experience in terms of what I knew about it. Had I ever looked at it when I was working with clients? And the answer is no, I never was looking at whether my clients had autism because we just weren't trained to do that in our program. Right. And so it just, you know, it hit me in a lot of different ways. And I notice, you know, when I even talk to other clients, we talk about what does it mean, what comes to mind when you think about getting diagnosed as an adult. And there's not a lot of information out there. There's really, there's not a lot of media. There aren't a lot of characters in movies that people identify, which is, you know, unfortunately a way that a lot of society will resonate with disorders or, you know, things like autism. And it just started thinking in my, I just started thinking in my mind, you know, what are some of the images that come to mind? And so, I'm thinking about one of my favorite shows that came, you know, that's been out recently, The Queen's Gambit. and how the female role, you know, it was never said officially or explicitly, but she had autism. And, you know, it resonated, it clicked. And, you know, the other people that we see are Elon Musk or Greta Thunberg, and then, you know, a whole spectrum of other people. And so I think that society just starts developing these images of what does it mean to have autism. And I think that, you know, plays a big role in how it's treated. And I'd love to share, you know, a funny story, a personal story of something that happened to me after I found out. And I remember going back to, I was working as a trial manager because I also have a background in law. And so I vacillate between, you know, practicing as a therapist, and then I'll also sometimes, you know, work in a law firm when I am feeling that I miss it. And so I remember having a conversation with the owner of the firm, who was a really talented trial attorney. And I mean, that's the hardest job to have as an attorney is to be, you know, a trial attorney, really intelligent, just incredible, incredible attorney and litigator. And when I told him that I had autism, I kid you not, he started talking really slow to me. He's known me a long time. And I was just so surprised and just sort of laughed, like, are you serious? I mean, I'm the same person. I'm just sharing something with you. And it struck me because he's a highly educated person. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there that have a lot of opinions and views. And so I think that contributes to the stigma.
I couldn't agree more. And thank you for sharing that story. I think that's so interesting. And I know we laugh, but I will tell you, and I've said this before on the podcast, I have 3 degrees in social work. I got my bachelor's and my master's in the mid to late 80s, and I got my PhD in 2001. If I learned maybe a half hour's worth of content about autism, and if I did, it was about children, that was a lot. And so I know that the helping professions are not being trained in how to assess or understand adults who are neurodiverse. How do we expect society in general to not have, you know, stigmas and stereotypes and fears and beliefs that aren't true? And I feel like this is almost the paradigm shift that I think is occurring now. And in a way, you know, the fact that we have access to so much on social media, and that so many young people who are either self-identifying or diagnosed are sharing their stories and sharing their experiences and telling the world how their needs can be met and how they want to communicate and what their social needs are, and maybe their sensitivities that they might have and accommodations they need at work. So I do feel hope for the younger folks and their generation, and hopefully older folks are getting educated. But the stigma is very challenging. And I do couples groups, and I do groups for neurotypical partners. And one of the things I hear over and over and over again is, I'm afraid to tell my family. I'm afraid to tell my children. I don't know how to share this with my boss or my coworkers. I don't know how it's going to be received. I don't know if people are going to understand what this means. And like you said, you know, the trial attorney starting to talk differently to you, slowing down, that I'm sure he did not mean to offend you or to probably even talk differently to you, but something clicked in his head that made him believe that he needed to treat you differently. And so this is really, really important. And I have not addressed this really on the podcast yet. So let's talk about, I don't know if you want to share how you have communicated with family or friends or other folks in your life? Have you found that you've been able to reduce the stigma and educate them?
That's a good question. It hasn't been easy because of what it means to other people in your family. If you have autism, what does that mean? Or if you're autistic. And I believe so far with all the research, and I keep an open mind, and I am always looking at the latest research to see where we are in terms of the cause and where it's coming from and you know, the different ways it can emerge. And I still see that strong genetic component. And if I'm autistic, what does that mean for my family members? And mm-hmm. what does that mean for my children? And what does that mean for my children's children? There's a lot of areas of, you know, conversation and mm-hmm. concern among, you know, some of the family that maybe aren't as knowledgeable. I know that there aren't a lot of clinicians in my family. Most of my family members are attorneys, to be honest. And that's a whole other conversation for us that I think is actually helpful for this. And that's in regard to, what does it mean if you have a diagnosis? And does that affect your career? Does that affect your ability to be licensed? Does that affect your ability to, you know, be in the military? Or what does that mean? And when I do assessments with clients, those are questions that we explore together to make sure that, you know, is there significance to a diagnosis? I know in some states, if you're diagnosed under 18, there's a mandate that it's reported to an agency. That mm-hmm. doesn't exist in California for adults, but it's monitored, and I think monitored for, you know, research purposes. However, that is something that leads to a stigma. And mm-hmm. and that's, you know, similar to mental health issues or substance abuse, anything like that, because, you know, it can show up in a background check. And so, you know, for to some degree, some of that fear and stigma is valid, especially mm-hmm. if, you know, you get a diagnosis and it's used against you to some degree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a real fear. But going back to the family, yes, you know, it's hard for the family to accept that. And if they're willing to, and what's their level of education? I know my grandmother never went to college. My mom didn't go to college. And so they're very intelligent women, and they've got a ton of knowledge, you know, that they've acquired through life. However, their understanding of, you know, what does that mean of being autistic is, you know, not as advanced as I would like. Mm-hmm. And so it's taking a lot of, you know, time to explain and look at it. And they're doing, you know, some sort of exploration for themselves of whether, you know, they can relate to some of my traits and what family line does it come from, or both. You know, there's so many questions that emerge once a diagnosis is made, I think, that we have to suddenly take a step back and look at the entire family tree and try to understand a little bit more about that sort of thing.
I couldn't agree more. And I think one of the things that you mentioned was fear. And I think that is a factor that drives a lot of the conversation. And I'm just going to use the word ignorance. It's because of ignorance. And I'm not saying it in a negative way. I'm saying that we as a society have not valued the importance of educating kids and adults on neurodiversity, and not just autism, but ADHD and dyslexia and dyscalculia and Tourette's syndrome, and then other issues like anxiety and depression. And, you know, one of the things that was kind of scary to me as, you know, a social worker, when I realized that I had been dealing with depression on and off since my daughter was born, During my separation from my ex-husband, the depression just exacerbated. I mean, the stress and everything else was, I think, reaching a point where I could barely function some days. And I fought, Nicole, going on medication. I had done therapy throughout my life. That did not scare me. Both my parents are were psychologists. They both passed away, and I'm a social worker. So therapy was not, it didn't have a stigma attached to it. But going on medication absolutely had a stigma attached to it. And how many people in this world are on antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications, right? But we still, as a society, don't see that as an option that should be welcomed when the person feels is necessary for them to continue functioning in a way that they can live their life the way they want to. We have that stigma related to mental health issues. And I think we have even more stigma related to neurodiversity. And so the fear of, number one, getting an official diagnosis, I think is very rampant, especially among older adults. But then being able to share that with your family. I know when I started talking about it with my family, there were a lot of questions. And my sister and I actually realized that my father was autistic. And he's passed away. He passed away in 2005. But my parents were in a neurodiverse relationship for almost 45 years. My mother and my father were in love. There was no doubt about that, but they struggled immensely. And now that I look at the family line, I know on both sides of the family, there are more people who've passed away that are autistic, and there are folks that are still living. Mm-hmm. You okay?
Am I okay?
Yes, it sounded like
yes. No, I'm listening. I'm just
no, it sounded like fascinated.
Oh no. Sorry about that. That's no. Okay.
So for me, the fear of taking medication was real. And now that's going to be on my medical record forever. Now, I'm semi-retired. I'm not worried about somebody checking my medical record and saying you have a past history of depression, we can't hire you for this job or whatever. I mean, I'm sure that happens. But I think what you're talking about is really real, that folks are very scared about coming out and sharing a formal diagnosis or self-identifying because of being ostracized, because of discrimination. So do you want to share anything more about that?
Sure. What comes to mind is something I can relate to, which is I'm still in the process of passing the bar for the state of California and to become licensed as an attorney. And part of that is a very extensive background check. And that involves opening up your medical records and letting the State Bar of California go through all of your mental health history, if you have any, your medical history, to ensure to protect the public. Mm-hmm. However, that is something that can be concerning to a person, especially if you don't understand what the measurement can look like. Can that disqualify you? And really, there's no rule or law that says it cannot. And so it would likely create, some hesitation in obtaining a diagnosis for some people, which is really unfortunate. And so some people do, pay out of pocket to do that sort of thing or to get mental health treatment. I have some friends who are, doctors that do that to keep it off the record. So mm-hmm. they don't have to answer questions or go through anything like that, whether it be, malpractice insurance, any of, the investigations that they may do. It really can come up, unfortunately, in some scenarios. So it makes, it makes a lot of sense that there's valid fear in regard to the discrimination. Yes, that's a challenge too. If you're looking for accommodations, whether that be in the school or at work, which you're legally entitled to if you have a diagnosis or you have a disability, to help do your job better, sometimes, you know, that could discourage an employer to want to hire you because there will be a cost for them and they'll have to, you know, make some modifications. However, you don't ever have to disclose, to my understanding, at least, you know, with our state, you don't have to disclose what your disability is, just that you have one and that, you know, whatever those accommodations are that you need. So, you know, that's, you're protected in that way, but just depending on what your career goals are, you really have to, you know, think about those things. And it's awful in my opinion, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. if you're going to hesitate on taking a medication or seeking a diagnosis because of a career path, it just doesn't seem like that's fair for us in our pursuit of, you know, agency to do what we want for a job or choices for our life. You know, it's really, it's frustrating.
Yeah. And depressing because, yeah. I mean, you know, I know that I suffered way too long with depression because I fought getting on medication. I thought, I'm a social worker. I have 3 degrees. I was raised by 2 psychologists. I should be able to do this by myself. No, I needed help. I was on medication for 4.5 years. And if I hadn't been on the medication, I would not be talking to you today. I'm not saying that I would not be on this earth, but I don't know that I'd be functioning very well at all. And so I'm very thankful that my OBGYN, she was the one who pushed me to do that. But, you know, and you don't understand neurodiversity and your family doesn't understand neurodiversity and you cannot get the accommodations and the help and the support that you need. Unfortunately, I know many people who lived a life and are still living a life that doesn't allow them to be their most authentic self and to live their best life. And so I really would really like to talk about, you know, when autism can't be acknowledged because of people's fears. And it's almost like for me, my daughter is a lesbian and she never had a fear of coming out ever in our family. But she has so many friends that when they came out to their family, they were literally disowned. They either lived in their home and were constantly ridiculed, put down, treated poorly, abused emotionally and sometimes physically, or they were kicked out. So in a way, you know, I almost feel like neurodiversity and coming out as neurodiverse is another way in which our society prevents people from being their full selves. So I'm wondering if you have had any experiences where people have denied who they are because of the fear of how family members or colleagues or even their partner might treat them. Has that ever been a situation that you've encountered?
Yes.
Okay.
And what... this really lands on me in a heavy way personally and also with clients that I work with. And the first situation that comes to my mind, it floods me with such fear and shame and pain, deep pain, because my, you know, I mentioned I was in a neurodiverse marriage and I have 2 neurodivergent children, and their dad fought me for years to get them diagnosed and to get mm-hmm. them assessments because of his own experience growing up with the stigma and the shame. Mm-hmm. And so he could not bear the idea that his children would have a similar experience in school or in life. And so we literally had to fight it out in court. We had custody fights. It was so awful and painful. And I was not able to get diagnoses for my children until they were in high school. And by this time, my children hate school. And I love school. I have, you know, education similar to yours. And mm-hmm. I Loved it. My children, they cannot wait to be done. They don't want to go to college. They will, but their experience going through, a typical public school system without any sort of accommodation for their needs has really taken a toll on them. And so it hurts my heart deeply because I wasn't able to help their dad come to acceptance with that and to allow it. And so it just it breaks my heart. And but I and so I have a lot of empathy for parents that go through that. They do. And when there's a child with special needs in the family, the divorce rate is sky high. It's like 75%. And often you see a similar dynamic where mom, it's usually mom, is fighting for every single support she can get. Dad is either in denial or dad is just wants to accept things as is. They don't want to hope. They don't want to try and invest more of their just angst, maybe. I don't know. It depends on the couple. Everyone's different, but it can be a battle if you're not on the same page. Right. And some of that comes from their own self-loathing if they were shamed or if they're have some cognitive dissonance with their own, diagnosis or their symptoms or traits, or if they were bullied. It just brings such a complication to a relationship when both parties aren't wanting to get a diagnosis or talk about it or acknowledge it. And it can have a lot of denial. And that denial, I think, is very much tied to the stigma in our culture and amongst, I mean, we could get into a whole conversation about male toxicity and what it means to be a man in our society and how getting a diagnosis like this or being neurodivergent might have some sort of effect on that. And so it's harder for individuals to be open to it, open to the idea, open to, looking at it and how it's affecting their marriage or their relationship. And, I think that's important to look at.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for sharing that because I heard in your voice, how difficult that was to bring up. So I appreciate that because I think, again, we were talking about things that I've never talked about on the podcast, and that's something I've never talked about, how one partner may be pushing to have their children diagnosed because you're recognizing things, you're listening to podcasts, you're reading, you've seen other children who are dealing with similar challenges that got assessed and that got accommodations or whatever. And one parent isn't either willing to acknowledge it or they have their own trauma, their own challenges that they experience. And so it's very difficult for them to acknowledge what's going on with their children. So I really appreciate you sharing that. And maybe that'll be helpful for some of the listeners to know that they're not alone in that challenge. And I also think that what you said about the challenges that can happen in a neurodiverse relationship, not just a neurodiverse family, when one partner acknowledges that there is probably neurodiversity in the relationship and the other isn't willing to acknowledge it for whatever reason. And I think, it does depend on, I think, how secure we are in our own skin, how our family of origin treated differences, how our community treats differences. Because, I know a lot of folks who are neurodivergent have felt like they have been masking or camouflaging their entire lives. And, that has allowed them maybe to become really successful in their career, to be successful in certain relationships, and acknowledging a difference may, it's almost like a house of cards, will that house of cards then fall if you acknowledge that you're neurodivergent? Will you have to make other changes that won't feel as comfortable to you as the life that you've created for yourself? There are just so many things that I think not acknowledging autism and neurodivergency in your life can impact. What do you think? What are your thoughts?
I completely agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah. And go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking about the masking and how you can be incredibly successful in your work life and even in your interpersonal life if you have other people that are neurodivergent around you. If you've managed to, get into a relationship with another neurodivergent person that is not ADHD per se, 80 like autism and ADHD, there will be some issues, but autism and autism, I don't see as many similar issues in some of the couples I work with. And so sometimes, that can be a successful relationship. However, I completely agree that the masking, it's exhausting, obviously. I think you've talked about that before. And, at the end of the day, there's only so much energy left that the individual has to give. And, it needs to get divided up between spouse and potentially children and themselves. And there's only a little bit left. And so it's hard because oftentimes the spouse, is feeling so depleted and they don't get very much of that. But it's hard, you have to really step back and see how much is really available and that you are, even though it's a little bit, you're still getting some sometimes. But yes, I tend to go on a tangent. My mind has so many ideas I want to talk about with you. But
No, please go.
it is really, really tough to make any changes and modifications that might upset the career, that the system that they have going on that's working for them. There's a lot of reluctance. And what is their narrative about what does autism mean and what does being autistic mean? And there's incredible bullying that occurs as kids, anyone who's different. And what's really hard about being autistic is that if you have any differences and you aren't masking and those differences are detectable, the bullying is going to continue as an adult in society because if you start acting differently, you're going to be met with a reaction from somebody, most likely. Maybe not every time, but sometimes you might. And that's scary and uncomfortable.
And I think in adult life, the bullying can be there, but also the ostracizing. So I've seen this happen over and over again where the person who might be neurodivergent but hasn't come out or doesn't even know they're neurodivergent is ostracized by their coworkers. They're not invited to lunch. They're not included in conversation. They're not included in team meetings, or they're talked about behind their back, and that's the bullying piece. And so, and that can happen in families too.
Excuse me.
Because yeah, no, that's okay. That can happen in families too. And I remember, hearing my father talk about my ex-husband and not understanding him. And they're both neurodivergent, but they couldn't have been more different. If you meet one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. If you've met one neurotypical, you've met one neurotypical. And so where they were so different. I think my ex-husband at times tried to be more like my father because my father was a successful psychologist. He was successful financially. He was raising two children. He was still married, all these things. But my father could not understand my ex-husband, and he would tell me that. And he didn't see all the things that I saw that were strengths in his personality and the way he thought and the way he processed things and whatever. He only saw the challenges because my ex did not know how to communicate with my father because my father was masking. My father was big time masking. And I don't think my ex-husband had learned how to do that at the level that my father had. So it's interesting to look back now and to see how those conversations went, and that they weren't the greatest conversations for either one of them, but for different reasons. And so, one of the other things that I think is really important, and this is also connected to the stigma and the fear, I think sometimes in neurodiverse relationships, I hear this over and over and over again. And I don't know if this was your situation, that the autistic partner, before they knew they were autistic, they really were comfortable in the relationship. Even if there was conflict, even if there were challenges, even if things did not always go the way they wanted, they had created a life that worked for them. And because of mind blindness, they didn't necessarily understand maybe the emotional reciprocity needs or the communication differences and how that was affecting the relationship, or maybe even the socializing differences, because it wasn't something that was impacting their day-to-day life. They didn't really understand how it was impacting their partner. And then when both partners find out that one is autistic and possibly autistic ADHD or autistic ADHD and dyslexic, whatever the combination is, then it's almost as though it's a brand new relationship and you have to learn how to let go of that stigma, how to let go of that fear, how to embrace both your strengths as individuals and as a couple and understand each other's differences. But it's like, if you're just in that relationship and you're trying to figure that out with your partner and maybe you have children, to extend that beyond your nuclear family to your extended family and then to the workplace and, you know, your church or synagogue and whoever else you're involved with, that's a lot of work, Nicole.
It right? Sure is. It is. It's overwhelming. Yeah. And it's also the response and reaction that you will receive depends upon the knowledge and wisdom and tolerance and acceptance of the individuals who receive that information. And my stomach goes into knots just thinking about that, being that this information is just not widely spread enough yet. And so it makes sense that people would hesitate, even sharing to your outside family, to hesitate. And especially if, you know, those family members aren't going to receive that well, because, you know, it shines a light on maybe some of their behaviors. It's a challenge. It really is. And hearing about, you know, your dad and your father and your ex-husband and the masking and how, as someone who is masked as well, you don't even realize what you're doing. It mm-hmm. just seems like that's what you have to do. You're assuming that, like putting on a jacket when you walk out to the day. But yes, I'm still trying to, you know, identify what else I want to say on this. And it, you know, in the situation where the relationship has worked and the neurodivergent person is comfortable, I think we may have talked offline about this before, about how sometimes there is sort of a dynamic that occurs when there is a neurodivergent partner who has just an avoidant type of attachment, you know, just mm-hmm. is comfortable in that space of just not being very calm and stoic, and that's attractive to a lot of people, especially if a person is, you know, anxious or has a lot of emotional dysregulation within themselves. They really, and they're comfortable with having to work hard for love or attention. That dynamic seems to happen frequently. And I mm-hmm. see that dynamic in a lot of the clients that I meet with. And I think the clients that, you know, you've shared that you work with. And so it can be hard to get one of the partners to recognize that there's neurodivergence there, and it's not the partner who is frequently emotionally dysregulated, because there's this belief that is formed that it's the partner that's often dysregulated that has trauma.
Right.
So, you know, the neurodivergent is less likely to really see their part of it. It takes work and time to you know, let that emerge. And once that does emerge, then what does it look like? Creating a new relationship and letting go of the stigma.
Yeah.
that could exist, you know, so that they can understand each other. But it takes a lot of, you know, repairing the hurts, yeah. and which you know, covered a ton. But yeah, it's definitely, yeah, complicated.
It is. It's very complicated. And what you just said about the repair, it's so critical. And I've talked about this on the podcast before, understanding that there's going to be grief, because I think there's so much stigma attached and so much fear attached to maybe sharing your neurodivergency, that you're autistic. And I don't know. I mean, you're a therapist, you're a licensed therapist. This is part of what you do every day. I don't know if there's some advice or thoughts that you can give to couples who are feeling the stigma and the fear in their relationship. Because one of the other things I hear often from couples is, I'm tired of being pathologized. And I hear this from the autistic partners. I'm tired of my partner saying this is all about me and the fact that I'm autistic now that I've been diagnosed or now that I self-identify. And I want couples to get away from that. I want them to find, if they need to, a third party that can help them, because the more we pathologize and the more we blame one person over the other for where we are in our relationship. And believe me, I blamed my husband for so much. And, you know, during our separation, he blamed me for a lot of stuff too. But it takes two to tango. It's definitely two people not knowing how to communicate with each other in a way that will be received by the other in a loving, kind way. It's not understanding each other's sensory sensitivities, if you both have them. It's not understanding your social quotas. It's not understanding the way you like to be loved, you know, your love language or any other way you want to describe that. It's not understanding all of those things and therefore being scared and having fear around maybe the changes that are going to have to happen. And I say have to, because many of them have to happen in order for each of you to feel safe in the relationship, to rebuild trust, and to value each other's differences rather than pathologizing them. And what I just said, I think is important, but is so difficult. So difficult to live it, especially if you've been in a relationship with somebody for more than a year, because the first year is usually, you know, the honeymoon phase, maybe even the first 3 years. And then mm-hmm. you're like, oh my gosh, you know, we're in a new relationship. We are now in a neurodiverse relationship. You know, our brains are wired differently. You know, we have to relearn what works for us as individuals and we have to relearn what works for us as a couple. And that's scary, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is. It is scary.
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me. I'm about to talk. Pathologizing is really, really tough. And it happens a lot, especially in anger. And I cringe when it happens because it's so painful and hurtful. Mm-hmm. And I really try to encourage the couples not to pathologize each other, because they tend to do it back and forth. You know, oh, it's your trauma, it's your autism. It's hard. It's hard for them to stop doing that, but it takes, you know, regulating and taking those words out of the communication. It's kind of like, don't say divorce unless you're going to get divorced. Yeah. We have to just remove those, because they're attacks. It's really hurtful.
Yeah.
And I love what you're saying. It's incredibly true that when you discover that you're in a neurodiverse relationship, the lens of how you're seeing your relationship really has to change. There has to be healing for the old wounds and identifying whatever you're bringing to the table from your past, from your own inner, you know, children. That has to get healed as well, because that's probably still showing up in the relationship. And then you have to look for a new way, just as you said, a new way of relating, a new way of defining the relationship and discovery of what the strengths are that exist. Yeah. There are some changes or there's some new behaviors that can be developed. And in my opinion, that's a really promising way of viewing the relationship rather than focusing on the past hurts and the pains when you can leave those in the past and you can see your partner who they are, not who you want them to be. And can you love them? Can you find satisfaction and fulfillment in that relationship for who they are and who you are? And that's what, we really have to do that work. So it's not a quick fix, but it's certainly something that you can do. It's not easy, but it's doable.
I agree. And that's what I try to do. I try to, give hope with every conversation that I have on the podcast because, I'm sitting here talking on the Neurodiverse Love podcast as a woman who was in a 30-year marriage, has been divorced for almost 5 years. But I say this often, I still care about my ex-husband. And, I tell my daughter if he needed anything, and, she said, Dad needs this. Can you help? I would absolutely be there to help him. We spent 32 years of our lives together just because we couldn't come to a place where we could understand each other's differences, forgive each other, and move past and work on ourselves as individuals and work together as a couple to move forward doesn't mean there still isn't, some positive regard for my ex-husband. But I will tell you, there is tremendous, tremendous stigma and I think fear in the family regarding autism because it's on both sides. It's on my side and it's on his side. And it isn't a negative. And that's what I've tried to share with everybody in the family. In fact, it's a positive when it's acknowledged and you view your life through the lens of somebody who has, and this goes for the neurotypical or the non-autistic and the autistic partner, you each view yourselves as people who have tremendous strengths in very different areas. And in the areas where you have complementary strengths, those are opportunities if you choose to stay together, where you can work together, where you can, be partners. Because I'll say, I may be doing a podcast, but as far as technology, oh, Nicole,
Yeah, I'm here.
as far as technology, Nicole,
That's my
I
notebook. I'm so
suck.
sorry about
That's okay. I
that.
suck. I suck with technology. And my daughter and my sister will say, well, look how far you've come. Yeah, but I'm not good at this. The amount of brain bandwidth it takes me to do anything related to technology is a lot. But I've decided to face my fears, to face whatever stigma I had regarding my challenges in this area, and work towards making improvements. I will never be at the level where my ex-husband and my daughter are, ever, ever, ever. But then they did not have or do not have the same strengths I have when it comes to talking to strangers about any subject, which makes me a good podcast host, right? You know,
Absolutely.
they could never be social workers. Neither one of them in a million years could do that. They still, I think, don't understand how I did that for, 30 some odd years. So we all have our strengths, but when we focus on our differences as deficits and we look at our partners through a pathologizing or stigma-based lens, I think that's where we create challenges and problems. So, any last thoughts? And then I want to talk about, and I did this in season one. We talked about lessons learned. So I'd like to know if you have any last thoughts on the subject of stigma and fear, and that sometimes autism will never be acknowledged either by your partner or in your family. You have any other last thoughts about that? And then we'll go to lessons learned.
I do. I have a few thoughts. I think that finding a way to accept reality for what it is and not argue with reality, that gives us such peace. And I wouldn't change my brain for the world. If I had to make a choice, I would not. That's my favorite part about me. And I know that a lot of people that are neurodivergent feel the same way. And I think it makes us special. I think if we view life through abundance versus scarcity. And we find a way to find gratitude of our partners and appreciation and of our lives. We're able to move away from that focus on the deficits.
Yep.
And it's an intentional effort. And, you know, it takes work and practice, but it's doable. It, mm-hmm. You know, I really believe that. And I think that having compassion and empathy towards ourselves and our family members and those, they're not going to understand. There are people right. that are in our lives that will never understand. And it's private. This is your story. You don't have to share if you don't want to. It's not an obligation. And with regard to your own family, I struggle with that. And I empathize for those who aren't yet there to embrace that. And I hope that somebody that comes for them. It does take time sometimes to get used to the idea. And, you know, I find that if we learn more about it and are open-minded, that maybe it could make it a little easier.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I agree 100% with you on that. And I think, Nicole, for me, the lesson that I've learned around stigma and fear is nobody wants to be called out. I shouldn't say nobody. There may not be a lot of people in your life who want to be called out for their differences if they feel that they are stigmatizing. Okay. Now, people feel great about being, the top musician, the top performer, the top, you know, attorney, whatever. You know, if they're at the top of their game in some area, I think a lot of people like the accolades and they like the prizes and the awards and whatever. But if they're being told that they're different in a way that isn't, what the norm of society is, I think that's a lot more difficult. And I've said this before on the podcast, and it isn't funny, but I can laugh because I have to. Otherwise, I'd be like beating myself up. When I discovered that I thought that my ex was autistic, I had so much knowledge that I was gaining by reading every book I could get my hands on. We were separated at the time, listening to every podcast, watching every video. I was like deep diving. And then when I told him, he was having a meltdown. We were away for the weekend and I screamed it at him, Nicole. I screamed it at him. And I said, I think you have Asperger's. And I know that's not a term that a lot of people even use now. And I understand why. So, and I think you need to get assessed is what I said. And it became a horrible fight that night. Neither one of us slept. It was just one of the nastiest fights we'd ever gotten into. And I realized that I not only stigmatized him and pathologized him, I put him probably in such a fear-based state. I mean, he was already having a meltdown regarding something. He was very upset about something that had happened. And I had absolutely no compassion or grace or understanding of where he was and what I was doing. And so I've shared this before because I want folks to know that I own what I did and I know it's wrong. And I've apologized to him many, many times and he's accepted my apology. But the more we criticize and the more we put our partners down or we put ourselves down because of our differences, the less as a society we are going to be able to acknowledge the strengths and the unique qualities that we have because our brains are different, period. So that's the lesson that I learned. And I've taken that lesson into future relationships that I've had. So yay for me that I've learned, but boo for me that I did that to my ex-husband. That was not good. So what about you? What any lesson or lessons that you learned that you want to share with the audience?
Yes, and I think so many people can relate to what you're describing, and owning it and apologizing, I think that just it makes such a difference. And yes, if we are criticizing or we're labeling our partners or ourselves, there isn't going to be much progress. And I will tell you that in my own head, when I start to feel critical of myself, I love the term neuro-gifted and neuro-talented.
I love
Give
that.
myself some sort of affirmation to just, accept and embrace and just understand we're all human and we all want to be connected. And if we can just accept that of ourselves and others, that's kind of what I've learned is just try to be compassionate. And the last thing, try not to engage when you're activated and angry. Don't speak. Just write it down. Go calm down and then come back later.
Yes.
That's my takeaway.
Yes, that's so important. I actually shared that with one of the groups. I said, write down what it is you want to say to your partner when you're activated. Do not say it. Put it in your phone, write it on a journal, go for a walk and speak it into your phone, whatever. Do not say it because when, and I'm guilty of this over and over and over again, speaking when I was dysregulated, because when we do, we can't take back those words. And it's probably not really what we want to say from a place of love and caring and, valuing our partner. So great advice and great lesson. So thank you, Nicole, and for our audience. I am so excited that Nicole's going to be coming back for numerous episodes. And again, if you have some questions or some topics that you'd like Nicole and I to address in the future, I hope you'll send me an email at neurodiverselove, the number four, the letter U at gmail.com, or you can send me a DM on Instagram, and that's neurodiverse underscore love. So thank you, Nicole. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to our next episode.
Great. Thank you so much, Mona. I love being here. I really appreciate it.